there's the cot there with the patient laying down, bearing their soul. And the patient's saying this: "Sometimes, even if I stand in the middle of the room, no one acknowledges me." And the patient, in this case, is an elephant standing in the room, and no one will talk about it. And so we are talking about an elephant in the room in this sermon series that we're in. The series is called Hold the Tension. And we're talking about political issues. Now, we're not talking about specific issues themselves, but rather we're talking about how we carry those issues, especially when we feel some tension around them. How do we carry them? How do we talk about them? How do we relate to one another in the midst of them? And when we see things differently, how do we hold the tension? I have several convictions around these issues that shape my thinking today, but really all the time and all throughout this series. One of those convictions is that we should be able to talk about any issue in the church. We should be able to talk about the elephant in the church, including political issues. That's one conviction. The second one is we should be able to talk about those issues with courtesy and with grace, pursuing mutual understanding. But we should be able to do it in those ways. We should be able to do it without name-calling, you know, without jumping to conclusions, without leaving angry. We should be able to have those conversations in those kinds of ways. That's my second conviction. And my third one, then, is that at the end of the conversation, we should be able to maintain unity in the essentials and charity toward one another in the non-essentials, in the areas where we differ. So these are my convictions. This is what I bring to you as we work our way through these matters. And I want to take you this morning to Romans chapter 12. That's the text that we're going to dive into this morning. Paul is writing his letter to Christians in Rome. It's the first century. And the first 11 chapters of Romans are full of rich, powerful theology. And then as we get to what we know of as chapter 12, of course, when Paul wrote the letter, he wasn't writing in chapter and verse, but editors went back later to help us keep track of where we are and where we're going. And so as we come to chapter 12, what we find is sort of a pivot from the richness of the theology to kind of the practical implications. Now, what does all of this mean for how we live our lives? And so we pick it up. Verse 9. I'd encourage you to follow along with me. "Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in love. Honor one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with the Lord's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge. I will repay,' says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." So you read those words, and it might feel like kind of a laundry list of different instructions. But I'd like to suggest to you kind of an organizing principle for it, and it really starts in verse 9, the first one we read, in that first sentence, that love must be sincere. And so I'm going to suggest to you that instruction is a BHAG. You know what a BHAG is? Some of you business-minded people might. About 20 years ago, in a book by business guru Jim Collins, he talked about BHAG. That's an acronym. It means big, hairy, audacious goal. That's a BHAG. And I'd suggest to you that Paul, in a fashion, is giving us a BHAG. A big, hairy, audacious goal, and that goal is genuine love. That we might live in genuine love. Now, you might say, well, I mean, that's a little anticlimactic. I mean, there's a lot in the Bible about love. And so why is genuine love, like, why is that a big goal? Why does he have to say that? Well, maybe a few reasons. So he calls for genuine or sincere love, in contrast to phony love or hypocritical love. And maybe the reason that he needs to point that out is because Christians can sometimes be viewed as hypocrites, as phonies, you know, as people who talk a good game when it comes to love, but when it comes to actually going beyond talking about it or thinking about it, actually show it, actually live it, actually put it into practice. And so some look at how Christians actually live and say they're hypocrites, they're phonies. And you know what? They are. They are. I am. You are. Everyone is. We are hypocrites. Because you see, none of us perfectly, consistently puts into practice everything we believe, every conviction that we have, all the time, without exception. I mean, all of us are kind of mixed bags when it comes to actually living out truthfully, authentically, with integrity, who we are and what matters to us. So in some area of life, every single one of us, I would make the case, is a hypocrite. You know, what we want and what we think and what's going on inside of us doesn't necessarily match with what's going on the outside. We are hypocrites. And so we need Paul to tell us to love sincerely, to love genuinely. And here's the other thing. To actually do that is quite difficult. And so I think he goes on, and I said, I think this is kind of the organizing principle, is this genuine love for the rest of what follows. He goes on and he gives us a picture of what this kind of genuine love can look like. And so he says things like, be patient in affliction. Bless those who persecute you. Live in harmony with each other. Live at peace. Do not take revenge, he says. And you might read those things and think, well, does Paul just want us to be a bunch of softies here? I mean, does he just want us to be like nice, easygoing wallflowers? But you read some of the other exhortations in this passage, and it would seem dramatically otherwise. He says, hate what is evil. Cling to what is good, and in fact, overcome evil with good. Never be lacking in zeal. Keep your spiritual fervor. Care for your enemy in such a way that it feels like you're heaping burning coals on their head. How about that? So Paul seems to be saying, be passionate. Have conviction. Live boldly. And live peacefully, and forgive, and show grace. Well, how are we going to hold all of that together? Well, Paul, I think within his instructions, gives us some ideas. So verse 10, he says, be devoted to one another in love. Now, I'm not going to take the time this morning. If we had time, I'd do a little word nerd moment here and take you into the original Greek that Paul uses. But if you were to read it in Greek, what you'd find is it's kind of an interesting sentence in that he uses a form of the word love, or at least our word love. I mean, there's different words in Greek for love, but he kind of mashes them up. And so in the original language, the essence of what he says is love one another in love. Isn't that helpful? You know, Paul is trying to be the head of the redundancy department of redundancy here, isn't he? Love one another in love. And the kind of love that he's talking about primarily is family love or sibling love. He's talking about loving each other as if you're family within the church. So, I mean, I would simply make this observation. Genuine love among Jesus' followers looks like family. That's what it's intended to look like, and looks like it's intended to look like the best possible family love and relationships. But there's something unique about family love when you compare it to friendship. And Greeks had a separate word for friendship love. It's different than romantic love. Family love is different than even self-sacrificing servant love. Family love looks different. And you know what, among other things, is different about it? You don't choose it. Now, my very first job, my coworkers there had some favorite sayings that they liked to come back to frequently. And one of the things that they would say all the time is, you know, you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your relatives. And you know that that is true, don't you? I mean, family love is unique in that family members don't audition one another the way that we do in most other areas of life, really. I mean, we don't call it auditions, but we can audition other people to be our friends, to be our employees. You don't audition your family. You just get thrown together with them. And you don't choose it. And what can happen is, in the best of situations, what happens is a bond grows over time. There's attachments that grow over time in the family relationship, sometimes between very different people who would never choose to be together if they had the choice, but their family. And so they don't have the choice. That's the kind of love that Paul wants to see happen in the church. It's the kind of love that happens in family, and it's frustrating to have to deal with that in those family relationships, and yet it is good. You know, it's good to have to deal with that. C.S. Lewis, talking about that kind of family love that where you don't choose each other, says, dogs and cats should always be brought up together. It broadens their minds. And that's how it should be in the church, where our commitment to Jesus brings us together with people that we might not otherwise choose, and yet there's a bond that can grow. There's an attachment that can grow. There's care that can happen. And so then the question becomes, how do church family members relate to each other? And again, Paul continues kind of giving us some illustrations of what that can look like. And so the second part of verse 10, the next sentence is, honor one another above yourselves. Honor one another. In other words, acknowledge or recognize the value and worth of the other people. Now, we like to honor people. I mean, our culture honors people. But you know the people that our culture teaches us to honor. They teach us to honor the Patrick Mahomeses of the world, don't they? I mean, the people who accomplish something, the MVP, the great people. Those are the people that you really honor. And the gospel of Jesus Christ teaches us instead that to God, they're all MVPs. That every single person has infinite value because they are made and they reflect the image of God. Jesus died for every person. God wants to send his Holy Spirit to live in every person. And so every person is a person of immense value, a person worthy of honor. That's what can enable family members to live together, is when they have that kind of honor for one another. And you know, that kind of honor was a feature of the early church. Historian Rodney Stark, looking back on the early years of the church, says the only place in the Roman Empire where you could get different ethnicities and classes of people together and have them relate to each other in positive ways was the church. And it was because the Christians, when they got together, saw themselves as brothers and sisters thrown together in this family and attached to and committed to each other in love. And it was in the church that the unlikely people, the poor, the immigrants, the orphans, newborn babies, people that didn't receive honor in that culture, there they found it, among the church. And it can still happen today. I mean, family life is hard, right? Because by definition, you're thrown together with people you don't choose. But the beauty of the best of family can still happen in the church. And so the question that I want to walk through for the last few minutes together is how can we love and honor each other as family? And that has implications too for when we have political differences from one another. How do we still love and honor each other? And so here's where I would start. If we want to love and honor each other, then we seek to truly know each other. We seek to truly know each other. Author, journalist David Brooks wrote a book called How to Know a Person. A fascinating book that kind of breaks down what does it look like for people to get to know each other and to work through the challenges of that. He says this: there is one skill that lies at the heart of any healthy person, school, family, community organization, or society. One skill at the heart of it all. And that is the ability to see someone else deeply and make them feel seen. To accurately know another person. To let them feel valued, heard, and understood. That's at the heart of healthy relationships, really, is the ability for the other person to feel known. Now, we think knowing is, well, you know, I saw them at the grocery store and I knew who they were. You know, I recognized their face, or I remembered their name, or you know, I know a few facts about them. I know, I mean, if they have kids or what their job is. I mean, we think knowing is like that. And it can certainly include that. But to really know a person is a whole lot more. You know, in the biblical text, when it talks about one person knowing another, it could mean a whole lot more. It could mean being familiar with, yes, but also you know this person because you've studied them. I mean, you know this person because you have concern for them and you've shown that concern. You've maybe made a covenant or a promise with that person. You've understood their reputation. Even sometimes when it says one person knew another, it literally means that they had sexual relations with that person. It's kind of a euphemism for to know. If we want to love and honor someone, I would suggest to you that where it starts is with knowing them. Knowing them deeply, knowing them experientially, knowing them as they are, not as we wish they might be. Well, how does that happen? What happens as we ask questions, as we hear conclusions without assumptions? If we're going to love and honor each other, Brooks says this: if I'm going to get to know you, it's not because I have the magical ability to peer into your soul. It's because I have the skill of asking the sorts of questions that will give you a chance to tell me who you are. It's been tabulated that the average child between the ages of 2 and 5 asks 40,000 questions. Some of you have one who's probably at about 39,000, and you know, you're feeling kind of crazy. What happens is that number diminishes as they get older. You know why that is? Well, because I imagine they're either taught or it's caught that, you know, you shouldn't ask that. I mean, that's too personal. You can't ask those kinds of things. Or maybe we stop asking questions because there's risk involved. You know, it's a risky thing sometimes to ask a question, because you're showing vulnerability when you do. You're saying, there is something I don't know, and so I have to ask. And that can be a hard place to be. When Kim and I lived in Lancaster, we took our vehicles to a certain mechanic. And when I pick up the car after it had been worked on, I mean, this mechanic would go into great detail about everything that they had done. You know, we had to change this and update that and replace this. And probably the next time it's here, we're going to need to do this, and this. And occasionally he would, you know, kind of in his little monologue, he would start to laugh. And you know what I did? I laughed right along with him. And I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about for any of it. And I wasn't going to ask, because that's a vulnerable place to be. You know, what if he thinks I'm stupid? He might be right, but I don't want him to think that. You know, when you ask a question, you might reveal your ignorance. You might have someone else think that you're dumb. They might not like you because, well, doesn't everybody know that? It's a vulnerable place to be. And that's one way to look at it. Or we could see it as showing the other person honor. We're honoring them as someone who has knowledge that we don't have, that is worth knowing, that is worth hearing about. They have knowledge worth sharing. David Brooks says, I've found in almost all cases that people are too shy about asking questions, not too aggressive. There was a Harvard study done in 2012 by a bunch of neuroscientists. And what they found is that in some cases, people derived more pleasure out of sharing personal information about themselves than they did from receiving money. Would you like to test that out? I might. Ask questions. Ask questions and then be patient and listen to the responses. And I worded that point in a very specific way. Listen to the responses the whole way until you hear the conclusion. Monica Guzman is a journalist who works with a group that tries to bring Republicans and Democrats together to talk about what they believe. And coming out of her experiences, bringing them together, she says this: the experience of being listened to all the way on something until your meaning is completely clear to another human being is extremely rare in life. Extremely rare for any of us to feel like someone else has listened to us the whole way until they have fully understood what we're saying. Maybe because we're all in a rush, maybe because we're distracted, lots of possible reasons, but we don't always listen well. I'd say maybe frequently we don't. Ask questions. Hear conclusions. Do it without assumptions. You know, we so quickly jump to conclusions. We make assumptions about motives. I love what King Solomon, wisest man who ever lived, said about this matter. He said, "The purposes of a person's heart are deep waters, something unfathomable. But one who has insight draws them out." Politically speaking, what if we set aside our usual approach of having conversations about tough issues? And you know what our usual approach is. Well, whatever else happens, I need to make sure I make this point. What if we set aside that approach and instead our goal was to know deeply what the other person thinks and why they think it? And maybe even like, what life experiences did they have that got them to the point of holding that view? What if we approached it that way? And so we asked questions, and then we asked more questions, and we asked more questions, and we continued to listen without jumping to conclusions, because once we start talking about politics, we jump to conclusions, you know, from 0 to 60 in a second flat. What if we withheld those judgments and we listened the whole way to the end? What if that was our goal? I suspect that if it was, what would happen is it would cement our family bonds, even among those of us who had radically different views. Maybe I should just say this. Online spaces, not a great place to do this kind of thing, are they? I mean, to deeply know someone, super hard to do. So maybe we need to have a few more old-fashioned face-to-face conversations. And I know none of us has time for that kind of thing, but maybe we should. Maybe we need to. It's hard. I know. And you know, part of the reason that it's hard to have these kinds of conversations is because our instincts are against us. You know, like literally our body physiology works against it. When a person says something that you disagree with on a subject that is very important to you, you know what happens? Our body registers a threat. And so the adrenaline starts pumping, and our brain starts diverting the blood to away from, you know, non-essential functions like having nice conversations to, you know, like it's survival time. You know, the blood flows away from the brain to the arms and the legs, and so you end up approaching these conversations with kind of the intelligence of a rodent. So our bodies do work a little bit against us. But you know, Jesus is for us. I should give credit to where I heard this point. This was from one of our groups last season that Melissa Snyder was teaching on how we have difficult conversations. Even when our instincts and our bodies seem against us, Jesus is for us. And so my last piece of advice for you is to rely on our brother's help. You know what brother I mean, don't you? Jesus. In Romans 8, Paul calls Jesus the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. He says that God planned to conform us to be like our brother Jesus. But he made us part of his family, and he invited us to come and find mercy and grace to help us in our time of need. And so our brother wants to help us. And Jesus, I mean, he mastered all this stuff. Actually knowing people deeply, seeing them, making them feel honored. He knew how to do it. And he wants to help us do it. And you know, the stakes are so high. David Brooks talks about the decline in social relationships across our country. And he says that at least one root of some of the violence and the political division that we see is people feeling lonely and unseen. According to one statistic, lonely people are 7 times more likely to get involved in politics than those who are not. Because they feel like, I guess they can make a difference there in one way or another. Well, we're not going to change. I'm not arrogant enough to think that we here at EBIC are going to change the country or the world. But could we have an impact in our small corner of it? Could we become a place where diverse views can be spoken and you can still be part of the family? You can be known and loved and listened to even if we don't all agree on every single thing? Could we be a place that doesn't just accept people, that doesn't just, you know, give them a place to belong, but actually a place where if they challenge us a little bit, you know, we're willing to hear what they have to say? Could we become more and more of that kind of community? I'd like to believe that with God's grace and the Spirit's help, that we could. And that it would make maybe even a bigger difference than we might think it would. Would you pray with me? Jesus, you know us deeply. You know the mix of emotions and motives and perspectives that is in every one of us. And still you came for us, still you lived for us, you loved us, you died for us. So that all that is wrong, so all that is sinful, so all that is rebellious could be put to death. And so that we could have new life in you. Thank you that your seeing and knowing us led to your transforming of us to be more of the people you call us to be. I pray that you would help us to see you and to know you more clearly. And as we do, that it would change the way we see and know and love one another. In the family that you've placed us in. I pray it in your name, Jesus. Amen. I'd invite you, if you choose, to stand, and we want to sing of what Jesus has done for us and who he is to us. Let's worship.